Nevada's death penalty might be eliminated, mining might be taxed at higher rates, Airbnbs might get taxed, and the state might create its own health insurance option. That's a lot of mites that in the coming weeks might be decided by state lawmakers. Here to break down the many bills and proposals being debated in Carson City are Steve Sebelius, government and politics editor of the Las Vegas Review-Journal, and John Ralston, publisher of the Nevada Independent. Steve, John, welcome back.
Hi, Joe.
Thanks, Joe.
So, John, I'm going to start with you because just yesterday, Governor Steve Sisolak held a press conference. He talked about higher tax revenues than expected. And with some $4 billion coming to Nevada for local state operations from President Biden's rescue plan for COVID-19, he said this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. But to do what?
Spend money. Lots of money, and that's what the legislators and governors like to do. It's still very unclear. I believe it's about three-quarters of that $4 billion that goes to the state. It's still very unclear how they're going to be able to spend that money, what they're going to spend it on, if it's going to be restricted to certain areas. There's going to have to be a special session almost certainly to do that. But the Economic Forum, which by state law sets the contours of the budget, also came in with some extra money in the projections. And so they're going to be able to spend that, and they're going to be able to restore some cuts on that. So instead of arguing about cuts, they're going to argue about who gets what pet project, who gets what pet idea to fund. And they like being in that position a lot better.
Now, this is a one-time windfall. You know, that's not coming again. It's not really based on increased revenues. So do you anticipate them creating new positions or filling positions that were let go during the pandemic? I mean, you don't want to create new positions that you're not going to have money for in the future to fund.
Yeah, they've never done that before either, Joe. Listen, using one-shot money being used for operations is nothing new for the legislature. But again, this is going to be decided in the horse trading in the last 3 weeks or so of the session that are left. And the real key player on all of this is not so much the governor, although he has veto power, but it's Maggie Carlton, who was the head of the Assembly Ways and Means Committee in her final session, and she is thinking about legacy, and she is the gatekeeper. And so she, and to a lesser extent, Chris Brooks, who's the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, are going to be the gatekeepers for this extra money.
And Steve Sebelius of Las Vegas Review-Journal, Maggie Carlton, as John said, as the gatekeeper, what is she known for, or what do you think she wants to be known for?
Well, I know that before the session, she certainly didn't want to be known for the cuts that we thought would be necessary to be made in this session. She was dreading that job, and I think she's very pleased now that the Economic Forum has come back with higher than expected tax revenues, and also that there is federal money. So even the other day, she was talking about, having to make some very difficult cuts with the budget that they were working with at the time. And she doesn't like that. I think, as John said, she's looking for legacy. She's the longest serving female a lawmaker in state history, and I think she wants to cap her career, putting the budget in a good place for subsequent sessions.
You know, Steve, Nevada has so many needs. We rank in the bottom of so many national polls and categories. From your viewpoint, and I'm really kind of asking your opinion, but you've covered politics here for so long. You know what the state's needs are. Where do you think the greatest needs are?
Well, Joe, what this state needs is a good 5-cent cigar. That's my personal preference. But I think if you look at the state budget, Joe, you'll see where the state believes the greatest needs are. 72.1% of Nevada's budget is divided between two things, and that's health and human services and education. That's the vast majority of the state's general fund spending, and I think those are the two greatest needs. Those are the two most important things that the state has to deal with. Education has been called the equivalent to national defense in the federal budget. So those things are really where the greatest needs are, I think. And you can also add, you know, other things, the potential problems with foreclosures and evictions. You're going to have that backup that was created during the pandemic and that was stopped by government intervention. That government intervention may be lessening. And once that happens, you'll see a mini housing crisis. The housing prices are going up, so it's difficult to mitigate that. So little things like that. But I think the vast majority of the needs have to do with either healthcare and with education.
And we're going to talk a little bit more about education coming up. But John Ralston of the Nevada Independent, this week a big idea came out of the state. They want to create a public health option. In layman's terms, what is that?
Well, it's in layman's terms, it's what Bernie Sanders and to an extent Joe Biden also have talked about, and what was the big controversy when Obamacare was passed is whether there would be a public option in addition to what's available on the private market. This is very, very controversial. It is absolutely insane for this to be coming up so late in the session. It's so complicated. Nicole Cannizzaro, who was part of the interim study on all of this, has presented this very late. She's the Senate Majority Leader. You would think this would have a lot of momentum. Two things. First of all, there is a lot of opposition that has already coalesced from all the sources you would expect in the private sector. And it appears that this is emblematic of a big problem for the Democrats up there, Joe, which is the lack of communication with the governor's office. I don't believe the governor knew much about this bill. I'm not so sure he wants to sign a bill like this that is being proposed by the Senate Majority Leader of his own party. I'm not sure I am sure that the communication hasn't been great between the Senate leaders and the Democratic and the Assembly leaders, and between those leaders and the governor's office. And so you are headed on this bill and some others, I think, Joe, for a real train wreck at the end.
Yeah, she, in an article in the Nevada Independent, she strongly defended her views. She said this is something that they've talked about 4 years ago. And why is it such a surprise to everybody?
I think it's a surprise because the devil's always in the details in these bills. And our Megan Messerly put this all in context in the piece that you're talking about in the Nevada Independent, talking about how most people agree that the public health system here is lacking. And that was certainly exposed during the pandemic. But how you fix that and whether this is the right way to do it is open to debate. And healthcare can be a labyrinth. It's very, very complicated. And to just throw this into the mix with 3 weeks left, it's like a lot of other things that maybe we will or won't talk about here, Joe, is that there should have been conversations before the session and bills should have been introduced, ideas should have been introduced earlier to get a full vetting. But as Steve and I know from having covered the legislature for many, many sessions, that's usually not what happens. And it's part of what's really broken with that process.
Well, I'm going to count that as a no. That's not going to happen. But I want to ask you about another big idea that did come up earlier. It was in February, and this was the governor's idea to create sort of these tech company innovation zones or mini counties. That's dead, right?
It's dead for now. And
for
by
now,
the way, let me just go back real quickly to what you said. I didn't say the public option isn't going to happen. I just think
you didn't. I think it's not going to.
Okay. I think a lot of this stuff is still in flux and going to be negotiated. And what often happens when controversial ideas are proposed, and we can talk about this vis-a-vis innovation zones as well, is that they are turned into studies. They are dramatically watered down, so the original intent is not what passes. Innovation zones are dead for now, but I don't think the idea itself is dead. That's the sense that I get. The governor went way out on a limb proposing this. I think the messaging from the very beginning by all sides was just terrible. By all sides pushing this, I mean, was just terrible. And so even if there is something good here, and I think it's tough to find something good by the contours that have been drawn, here you have an option available only to the very rich to create essentially essentially their own government entities. No one's ever going to buy it that way. A state improvement district, something like that, that fits in with what already is in state law, maybe. But the way that it exists right now, it's dead.
And as you said, the messaging, the way lay people out there view this, as just as you said, you're giving rich tech companies this ability to create blah, 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 all that kind of. You're right. You're totally right. The people were talking about it everywhere about how could they do this. Steve Sebelius of the Review Journal, with the state suddenly looking flush with all this money, does it mean that ideas that were out there to create more revenue are that they're going to die? And I'm talking about there was a proposal to allow higher taxes on mining. There's something that just came up, a tax on Airbnb short-term rentals. Will this federal influx and the higher tax revenues that we're seeing, that higher than projected, I should say, are they going to kill those ideas?
Not necessarily, no. I think the mining tax issue has been around for a long time. It was on the ballot and very nearly passed in 2014. And I think that is a sort of a long-term tax issue. Mining is countercyclical. When the rest of the economy does poorly, mining does better. And it would be nice for the state to have that as a backstop for the inevitable next crisis that's going to come. We don't know what that's going to be, whether it's another recession, whether it is another pandemic, whatever that may be. It would be nice for the state to have that. So I don't think that idea is necessarily off the table. I think that's something that will still be on the table. Remember, this is a long-term process to do it. It would have to pass this session, and then the voters would have to approve it next year at the general election before it could go into effect. So I know that there are deals being discussed behind the scenes to prevent it from going to the voters. I think the industry doesn't want it to be on the ballot. Because it's much more difficult for them to argue against it. It looks self-serving, mostly because it is self-serving, for them to oppose it. And so some deal may be struck on the deductions that are currently in statute and don't need this long constitutional process to be changed. But I definitely don't think that idea is off the table, no.
John Ralston, you've been covering politics a little bit longer than Steve. I want your thoughts on this. This has come up every 2 years for almost as long as I've been in Nevada myself. Is something going to happen with the mining tax? Even the ability to tax at a higher rate, not forcing the tax, but allowing local governments to tax at a higher rate?
I think Steve laid out the dynamic up there very, very well, with one exception, which is that I don't think it's just the industry that doesn't want this on the ballot next year, and that is why a deal is probably going to be struck on some way to tax mining and then not try to get it off the ballot. The Democrats, I think, to some extent, have decided they don't want it on the ballot either, and they want this issue off the table because they're afraid, whether they're right or not, from a political calculus, that it's going to gin up incredible turnout, even higher than usual, in the rural counties who are opposed to this. They don't want that. I'm not sure that's the right political calculus. I think there's a lot of people in southern Nevada who would happily go out and vote for a mining tax. But I think there's a consensus developing up there among Democrats, Republicans, the industry, and progressives that let's do something right now. Let's not go through the long, arduous process that Steve referred to. And so I think a deal will be struck. But as Steve and I both have seen, deals are struck, deals fall apart, deals are struck, deals fall apart in the last few weeks of a session. So I wouldn't bet a lot of money on it. But of everything we've talked about, I think that's going to happen.
Look, is there anything about this session? And maybe this is not a wise question, but, you know, Democrats control both of the houses, executive branch controlled by Democrats. Is there anything about this session that feels better to you? Somebody very cynical about the whole process, but better. Is there anything good about what's happening up there this session?
No.
All right. And with that, it's less than a month now for state lawmakers to make some pretty hefty decisions. Taxes on mining and Airbnbs hang in the balance, as does the state's death penalty. John Ralston of the Nevada Independent and Steve Sebelius of the Review Journal are here to break down what our state lawmakers might do. And what about taxes on Airbnbs? That's a bill that hangs in the balance. And Steve Sebelius, I want to talk about that a bit. Local governments in Clark County have banned or restricted Airbnbs or short-term rentals for many years now. Neighbors of these homes are, you know, just get fed up with some of the partying and the noise that happens when tourists stay next door. But this Airbnb bill, could you talk a little bit more specifically about what it might do?
Yeah, this bill is controversial in one sense, because you have this notion that, you know, you own a piece of property and you're not allowed to do with it what you will. I live in a HOA community, and believe it or not, there's restrictions about how many homes in this little neighborhood of about 60 houses or so can be leased at any given time. And if a certain number are leased, then if I decided, for example, I wanted to lease my home, I couldn't do it. And I think a lot of people rebel against that idea. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you're right, these neighbors have decided that, you know, that this is just too much. And I get that totally. I get that. Something that, you really don't want. There's people, they're from out of town. They're never going to be there again. They have no incentive to behave nicely like you would if you were a neighbor who lives there permanently. So it is a big controversy. And I think that that issue of, you know, can you use your property as you wish through this idea that we didn't even know about 10 years ago, the Airbnb was, you know, have no idea what it was. That's going to continue, I think, to be controversial.
What about this bill? It would tax Airbnbs, but would it also ease or eliminate some of the restrictions on Airbnbs?
Well, you know, the there's always the tension, Joe, between local governments and state governments. We're what they call a Dillon's Rule state, which means that local governments only have the powers that are delegated to them by the state or any power that can be reasonably inferred from the delegation. So there's always the tension. You know, I know some communities want to just ban it completely and say, no, we're not going to allow that to happen at all for the peace of our residents. I don't know if that's, a realistic approach. The taxation ideas is something else. I mean, all the hotels here are taxed in that way, from Motel 6 all the way up to the Wynn and the Venetian. So you have equity issues there as well.
Yeah, and they really want this bill to happen. John, let's turn to something different. John Ralston of the Nevada Independent. There have been bills introduced to allow people facing terminal illness to die with the assistance of a physician for many years. Never passed. The bill is out there this time, and some say this might be the year it does. I wonder if this is one of those political minefields, something legislators would just rather not deal with.
Well, I'm sure that's right, but I do think it has a pretty good chance to pass. Again, some of these things are lost or found in the legislative endgame, but that one, to me, I think is not simply a partisan issue. I think there could be bipartisan support for that concept, and it has been around for a while, but I don't know where the votes are right now.
Is the same argument or the same thinking having to do, or is it different with the death penalty? Some people want to eliminate it. A lot of the GOP people say, no, we want to keep it. I mean, where do you think that's standing?
Well, it's a much different and much more high-profile issue of the death penalty as opposed to mercy killing. The bottom line is, Joe, is that this is absolutely suffused in the politics of 2022 for a governor who was completely against the death penalty, then said there might be exceptions for something like 1 October. And there is a straight ban that's up there now that is supported by the Democratic Party itself, which has been putting out releases and certainly was supported by the Assembly. And suddenly you get it over to the Senate, where the two gatekeepers there, the majority leader and the head of the Judiciary Committee, are prosecutors who work for a guy, DA Steve Wolfson, who is very much against repealing the death penalty. And there's Republicans, I think, are salivating over this because they believe most Nevadans, and the polling is a little all over the map on this, but they believe most Nevadans want the death penalty to remain. And you have the backdrop of the county's highest law enforcement officer, the sheriff, about to jump into the governor's race against Sisolak, and some of Sisolak's advisors, the governor's advisors, saying, don't let this bill come to your desk. And so to complete the circle here, Joe, this goes back to what I told you about the communication between a Democratic legislature, within the legislature, between the Assembly and the Senate, and with the governor's office. And suddenly this bomb is going to explode at the end. And there's another press conference this week of people who want the death penalty repealed to try to put the pressure on the legislature and the governor to sign it. They may try to amend it to put some exceptions in there as the governor has wanted, but how is that going to look? Will that satisfy progressives? Will that take away from Joe Lombardo, if he gets into the governor's race, as I believe he will, from using it against Steve Sisolak? Very complicated politics here. There are just some people who think you're either for killing people who commit certain crimes, or you're not. And I think that's how progressives feel, and that it's something that should be repealed here in Nevada. It's rarely used, as you know. It's rarely used anywhere. And so this one's going to be fascinating to watch because of the poor communications and the complicated politics here.
And Steve Sebelius, I want to turn now to electric vehicles and our electric highway infrastructure. Nevada has a few thousand registered electric vehicles right now, but we are next to California, and they have the highest number in the country. It was in 2015 or 16 that Nevada had the highest year-to-year jump in e-vehicle registrations. And now Senator Chris Brooks has a bill that requires NV Energy to spend $100 million on recharging stations and infrastructure. It would also let the state be part of a larger wholesale electricity market. That wholesale market section of this bill, why is that so important?
Well, I think, if you were to replace every gasoline car in Nevada right now today, just magically swap them out for electric cars, I just don't know that the grid would be able to support that infrastructure. At the same time, our skies would probably be a lot clearer because tailpipe emissions are one of the biggest sources of pollution anywhere. California recognized that. That's why California has provided incentives for people to buy electric cars. I was recently in the market to buy a new car. I didn't consider an electric car, and the reason was that they are still much more expensive. That's going to change, though. And as the electric vehicle price comes down to be more competitive with the gasoline vehicle price, I think you're going to see more and more people turn to that. And when you do, the demand for things like electric highways, for charging stations, will go up. But if you can picture a world in which we were all driving electric cars, and imagine every gas station that you know in town was actually an electric vehicle charging station, imagine the demand on the electrical grid, in addition to the regular demands that we have now for homes and businesses and everything else, that's just a tremendous amount of electricity that would be needed to do that. And so expanding the portfolio of sources and expanding the total amount of energy that's available is going to be critical as we transition to that. Eventually, we will all drive electric cars. That's just the reality. How quickly that comes about is an open question.
This wholesale market move, maybe would help NV Energy provide the electricity needed. But I wonder if, aside from this bill, if they're talking much about this, because we've had, for instance, Tom Skanky, who is a transit expert, on this program a couple weeks ago, and he said this is going to be a major, major issue in Nevada as more and more electric vehicles are coming. He said it's not going to be, in the distant future. He's talking in a few years. It's really going to start happening here.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think that the prices are coming down. They're not quite competitive enough now, and I think that's still going to be the major consideration for consumers. We all want to do our part for the environment. We all want to recycle as much as we can, and all that. All things being equal, who wouldn't opt for an electric car if it was as effective and has the same range as a gasoline-powered car, and you could refuel it wherever you needed to. But those just aren't the case right now, and so you have to wait for that infrastructure to expand. I think Tom's right, though. I think it is going to become more rapid, more common than it is now, and you're going to start to see the charging stations pop up more and more as that price comes down. But as we do that, you know, we have to be cognizant of the supply. And that's going to be a real issue, just as you know, just as we have to be cognizant of the gasoline supply and the price related to that. So all of those issues are part of this mix. But the bottom line is, yes, the electric cars will become more common, and the need for a greater amount of electricity is going to increase as we get closer to an all electrified vehicle fleet.
And John Ralston, this might be, I think, at least from the reporting that we've all done on people who could not get their unemployment benefits during the pandemic, this might be the most important issue. And that is a move by the GOP. They say they want to provide $40 million a year, the state to pay $40 million a year to upgrade basically Dieter's computer system, their employment. There seems to be some pushback. Like the Democrats say, let's wait for federal funding. Let's not pay for it ourselves. But it seems like politically it'd be very smart to endorse something like that, since so many people are so angry for so many months about not getting their payments. But I want you to weigh in on that.
Well, some of this, of course, is just the reflexive partisanship that has afflicted Carson City, like it has many state legislatures, and certainly in Washington, D.C., the Republicans came up with an idea, so the Democrats said no. Now, the Republicans may have some good ideas on how to fix Dieter. The $40 million price tag, their essential attitude on that is, don't worry about it. The federal funds are coming. It'll be paid for. We still, again, do not know what the guidelines are on that federal money. So that could be an argument for not doing it. But Dieter is an absolute disaster. Even though they brought in a strike force headed by the incomparable Barbara Buckland, even though Elisa Caffaretto, who is heading it now, is someone I've known for a long time and is a very diligent person who understands state government. But this is just, people are furious, Joe, and you can understand why. We get the emails every day, as I'm sure you do and Steve does over at the RJ, from people who are just really angry about being caught up in this Kafkaesque system where they can't get benefits that they are due, and so that's not gonna go away. Now, you can say they've done their best, and maybe they have, but I think people in general, you either are suffering because of this system, or you know someone who is suffering because of this system. So this is both a substantive and political landmine for the legislature and the governor. And so I think they have to do something. Does it matter which party gets credit? Only to the parties up there.
Well, that's really interesting. Steve Sebelius, we talked about this before on this program. Consumption lounges, marijuana consumption lounges. Is that a done deal, like a slam dunk? Is anybody out there opposing them?
There really hasn't been a lot of opposition, and the opposition that we've seen has been fairly attenuated. Police saying we would just prefer consumption lounges, not also simultaneously serve alcohol, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there's a greater than average chance that this bill will pass. It's something that really has been a problem ever since this initiative that legalized recreational marijuana was passed. That initiative said nothing about consumption lounges for a very good reason. They didn't want people opposing it by saying Las Vegas will become a little Amsterdam. And so that was left completely out of the initiative. After that, there were many people, including the LCB, who argued, oh, no, local governments have the authority to authorize those. Mm-hmm. Well, the state preempted them from doing it. And so, as with most things, there's that state local government tension that we talked about earlier. I think this should happen. We've essentially created the entire state of Nevada as an attractive nuisance. Yes, marijuana is legal here. You can come here, you can buy it, you can possess it, But don't you dare light up anywhere in public, because if you do, you're breaking the law. That's a nonsensical approach to this policy. So that needs to be dealt with. But there's another issue, Joe, that's lurking behind this issue, and that is the impaired driving issue. And what standard are we going to use to adjudicate whether someone is impaired by the use of marijuana from driving a vehicle? The current standard that we have now that's been in place since early 2000s is absolutely wrong. It is far too low. It has no relation to actual impairment. There have been attempts to get an actual impairment standard in place. That needs to be fixed at the same time as we have these consumption lounges. In fact, that needed to be fixed before we legalized medical marijuana. But as always, in the ever pioneer state of Nevada, we fix things long after they have become acute issues.
And that's Steve Sebelius, Las Vegas Review-Journal's government and politics editor. John Ralston is also here. He's the publisher for the Nevada Independent. I want to thank them both for a very interesting analysis of this race to the finish of the 2021 legislative session. This is State of Nevada.